This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks to everybody for tuning in today. I appreciate it. We are going to have what I think is going to be a very interesting conversation. Of course, I say that every week. That's supposed to be how it works, right? We're going to be talking about difficult situations, difficult topics of conversation, decisions that need to be made in the public school systems. Our guest, all the volunteers come from Albemarle County, although that's not the the specifics. We're not going to talk about just difficult decisions in the Albemarle County school system. I think that a lot of this conversation will apply to just about every public school system in the state and even on a grander scale. We'll start over in our corner. Let's have all our guests introduce themselves. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
Good. Thanks for having us here. I am Billy Hahn. I am one of the assistant superintendents for Albemarle County Public Schools, and my role is I work with student learning.
Stuck over here in the center.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you very much for having us on today. My name is Matt Hawes. I'm the other assistant superintendent for Albemarle County Schools. I work with organizational and human resource leadership.
Hi, Rick. I'm Steve Colazar. I'm chairman of the county school board, and I've been serving on the board. This is my 18th year.
And thanks to the gentleman for coming in. I appreciate it, especially on a Sunday that's not so snowy. but let's start with that. We talk about difficult decisions in the public school system. And I'm going to toss you out an easy, difficult decision to make, because this is something that happens every year here in our area. We don't get a lot of snow for people to call us a true winter area. We're certainly not in Buffalo. But you still have to make the decision of when to close the schools and when to keep the schools open.
I'm just going to interrupt on that question before we get into the details of that. I think we have to always look at the overall structure and the overall organization. If you have a solid strategic plan, you have good working relationships between the board and the school board, these kinds of difficult decisions become easier. But I'll pass it over to the experts to talk about how we actually make that decision.
I'll go ahead, Rick, and start off, and then Matt can join in here or add whatever I leave out. You know, we do have a process that we have to evaluate our schools and our road conditions, and on any given day, that begins about 2 a.m. if there's a chance of snow or inclement weather that could affect our buses and the safety of our students.
Who's up at 2 a.m.?
Transportation folks and Josh Davis, who... Yeah, you know, people hear his voice on the phone all the time, and they love Josh.
that auto call, is that what that is?
It is. You know, those folks are out checking roads. We know where some of our most difficult roads are, the ones that tend to freeze or become very difficult to travel with our buses first. So they're out checking those roads, trying to make a good decision. Josh is in collaboration with folks from other divisions as well. He talks to weather service. He has several weather services that he checks to see what the forecasts are like. And, you know, they're out trying to make the best decisions possible. This year it's been interesting because we've actually had to deal on a couple of days with decisions not based on what the weather was like at 6 in the morning, but what it was possibly be like at 1:30 or 2 in the afternoon, because there's at least 2 days this year where the weather forecast had a high percentage of sleet, snow, freezing rain starting like at 12:30, 1:30 in the afternoon. And that's very difficult for us because we run dual bus routes. We have bus drivers who take elementary students home home and then come back and do a second run and take secondary folks home. And what that means for us is that it takes about 3 hours from the time that we make a decision to close schools early. It takes at least 3 hours for us to get all of our students delivered safely. So it's a very difficult decision when they're calling, you know, 80% chance of snow, freezing rain that's going to start at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. About do you even come to school or close school that day? So that's a difficult one.
Okay, one of the problems we have in Albemarle County is that it's so large a district. We may have impassable roads in one part of the county, but have perfect dry conditions in another part of the county. So as a strategic policy, we generally say if 80 or 90% of the kids can get into school safely, we'll open. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people who are in the dry part of the county don't understand why we're closed, because when we have many impassable roads in other parts of the county.
So I can't help escape the coincidence that the last song you played, the bluegrass song, was "Oh Lord, Put Me on a Smooth Road."
And as that Rusty Cimpre, he has quite the little quirky comedic sense.
He's got a great sense of humor. And as Steve mentioned, our land area for the county is 726 square miles. We're the sixth largest land area county in Virginia. So I think that it's important to keep that in mind. And 690 square miles of that is considered rural. Early on, just a couple weeks ago, actually, we go through a pretty significant calendar development process that includes surveying our community. And the goal is to be able to distribute those school days over a school year. There are 180. And we lay all that out into quarters so that we have reports of frequent progress, and we're always moving forward with student learning. And we keep all that in mind. But I would say that on any given day when you're trying to make that decision about whether you're going to have school, you're really thinking about each and every one of our 13,200 students. And really the big question is it worth it to get in a school day when you could potentially put some of those students at risk?
Well, we were talking, by the way, we are talking about difficult decisions in a public school system. That was one of our guests today, Assistant Superintendent Dr. Matt Haas. We also have Assistant Superintendent Billy Hahn, as well as Steve Kolzar. He's the chairman of the Albemarle County School Board. I heard so much of that conversation being about closing school early. What about bringing school in late? Because for the conversations that I have with friends and family are often about, gosh, why is school not open today? Look at these roads. And while I understand, in fact, I'd live on one of those crazy Albemarle County roads where when I see the bus, I'm already slowing down for what could be this top-heavy vehicle of transportation. But if you can bring in 80% or 90% of the school population in on safe roads, can't the county open for business and just say, folks, we're sorry, but it costs so much money for us not to be open that we would rather have as many people here as we can, and you're welcome to bring your own kid into school if you'd like?
Well, I mean, we have kind of set the limit about 80 to 90%. But if it gets below those numbers, that's when we're going to choose to stay closed. And you have to remember that the number one thing that we're concerned about in these instances is student safety. And I would hate to have an accident on a road where a student got killed because their parent was driving them to school mm-hmm. because we couldn't offer transportation. One of the things as we get into technology, I'm hoping that we can develop what we're going to call virtual school days, so that when schools are closed, students have work that they're supposed to be doing from home, whether linked online or just assignments that they have that they can do at home, so that we don't have to bring kids in when there might be a risk to students.
In the current state of the way rules and regulations stand on a statewide basis, would that count as an actual school day? If you were to start that tomorrow, virtual school days, don't the schools have to have X number of days
Yes, we do.
Would that count as one of those under the current rules and regulations? A virtual school day, would that still count as one of your 180?
Well, Rick, we've already built into next year's calendar where we are piloting that concept that Steve is talking about, where the first 2 days that we would miss for inclement weather, we're going to call those virtual learning days. And what we needed to do in order to do that, and I work with Dr. Hahn on that, was to actually calculate how many days we could miss in terms of what we call bank time, because our elementary days do exceed what is necessary for us to get in the minimum of 990 clock hours for the school year. And then you also go ahead and calculate out how many clock hours you're going to get per class at the high school level. So that's the first thing. You take that into consideration. I want to say it's not as simple as just saying, well, some of our schools are open and some aren't. What that does, I think Steve alluded to, is that if we said, well, our schools are all going to be open, come if you can make it, you do have sort of a subliminal pressure there that we're open. If you can't make it, you're going to miss something. And one of our mottos is that it's learning for all, and all means all. So when we're open for everyone. When we're closed for everyone to keep everyone safe.
Where do you rank this, snow day or not snow day on the list of difficult decisions that need to be made?
It's always a difficult decision. Anytime that you possibly close your buildings and close your school system and you're affecting the school learning, the instruction, and the teaching, the learning school and student, it's always a difficult call. And the other thing that makes it very difficult, because we're very aware, we like to have great relationships with our communities and our parents. And for example, we did a two-hour delay this past Friday morning, and Mr. Davis made a great call on that one, because right at the time the majority of our buses have been out running is when the sleet and snow was sort of starting to come down. And what he did with the 2 hours was it gave him enough time to see, is this really going to affect us and stick to the roads and cause us problems, or is it sort of something that's going to go by? But decisions like that are very difficult on parents, because a lot of parents go to work early and they have daycare issues, and it's a very difficult thing to start off with a two-hour delay, then all of a sudden you're going to close schools at 8 o'clock. Now you made a different decision than you did at 6 o'clock. So we're very aware of those decisions as well. So it does affect parents and what they do with daycare, whether you're closing early or opening late. So we're always aware, and that makes it difficult as well.
And there are difficult decisions that are unimportant and difficult decisions that are very important. Mm-hmm. Even though I think snow days are a difficult decision, in the terms of what's important for student learning, it's a relatively unimportant decision. There are many more important decisions that affect how much our students can learn and perform than whether we close on a snow day or not.
Beautiful. Well, then let's move on to some of those more difficult decisions, Rick, that are difficult that are more important.
If I could throw one thing in also, is that, as we go through and evaluate teaching and student learning, our superintendent does have the authority from the State Department to waive hours. So it goes back to that piece. Do we feel that students are learning what they need to learn and doing that, not just a seat hour measure piece anymore as well?
All right. Our guest today, Steve Colazar, he's the chairman of Albemarle County School Boards. We have both assistant superintendents. We have Dr. Billy Hahn as well as Dr. Matthew Haas here today. We'll give out the phone number in just a few minutes if you'd like to call and participate on today's show. And let's do this real quick, and then we're going to come back and talk about redistricting.
And support for WNRN today coming from T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And back to our guest, Steve Colazar. He's the chairman of Albemarle County School Board. And then we have the assistant superintendents from Albemarle County, Dr. Matthew Haas, as well as Dr. Billy Hahn. Gentlemen, I don't know who wants to jump on this first, but this was the topic that I saw locally reported that made me want to put this program together on difficult decisions, which is the commentary on redistricting that's under discussion in the Albemarle County area. But we all know that this discussion takes place in, if not every school district within the state, certainly in a noticeable number of counties and cities. And my understanding is that what brings this discussion about is that certain areas in our county have had a higher increase of families with students, so that one school or several schools now have more students attending than they were originally planned for, while other schools have fewer. Instead of being at 100%, you're at 120%, and instead of being at 100%, you're at 80%. Obviously, those are just made-up numbers. Who wants to jump in and tackle this? Because what I want to know is, at what point do you start to take these percentages into effect and what the process is?
I'll sort of start on that one, and I'm going to approach it from the teaching learning aspect, and then Matt can jump in on the strategic side of it. Any time that we have a building that is over capacity and it starts to affect the teaching and the learning, then it's time to do redistricting. Now, the problem is you can't wait till that happens. That's why we have a long-range planning committee that goes through and studies, 5 and 10 year projected enrollments. We have class sizes, school capacity numbers that we look at constantly. So there's a lot that goes into it. But from my side of the shop, when you have class sizes that are too large, you physically don't have enough space in a classroom for children, or you can't offer programs. We've actually had a couple places where enrollment went so quickly, happened so quickly, got large so quickly, that we were actually teaching some reading groups and some other intervention or enrichment services out in the hallways or in rooms that weren't designed specifically for teaching. That becomes a real problem for your school. So that's one of the major things that we really have to look at. We do have standards that the school board has established for how we staff our class sizes. For example, at the K-3 level, we staff them at like 20.25:1. So when those numbers start getting larger than that, or projected to get larger than that, then we start looking at the redistricting side of things. But
which schools are we specifically talking about? Because my understanding is that currently it's only the elementary schools that are under discussion, or that the committee of research was done specifically for some of the elementary schools, correct?
We're currently looking at two schools, Agner Hurt and Meriwether Lewis, which are both elementary schools. But one of the mistakes the school board made in our charge to the committee was not to determine any effect of redistricting elementary schools on middle school feeder patterns. One school, say Agner Hurt, is going to one middle school. If you move kids from that school to another elementary, which is going to a different middle school, that's something that we should have put in the charge, because that's looking at that not just from a very narrow focus, but a little bit broader focus.
Again, we are talking about difficult decisions in the public school system. Our volunteers, we're talking about this today, all from Albemarle County, School Superintendent Chairman Steve Colazar, as well as both Assistant Superintendents, Dr. Billy Hahn, Dr. Matthew Haas. Dr. Haas, continue on, because you have a different perspective on how the redistricting would work.
Well, I want to say that in terms of what Steve was saying, I know you might look at it as a mistake, but I really feel like the way the committees were set up and the process that we go through is a learning process. And so to me, the genius in how we do this work and the school board fosters it is that as these committees make their way through the process, they may discover aspects to it that weren't part of the initial inputs. I always like to back up a little bit, so you may be squeezing your hands together sometimes to get me back on topic, but I always come out, look at this from the strategic plan angle, where we say that we have four core values: excellence, young people, community, and respect. The one I think that really applies here is largely has to do with community. What we look at as a school system is how well are we using our resources so that we can have a real strong return on investment in terms of revenue that's provided by taxpayers, which then funnels into our educational program, and then how we allocate that in terms of facilities and how we allocate seats in those facilities plays out in terms of our respect for our community. When we look at things like long-range planning, as Dr. Hahn mentioned earlier, we invest in that through community involvement. There's a committee that looks at the big picture. They look at how our seats are being used at all the schools under the current state. They make recommendations to the school board. The school board steps back and decides whether or not to have a process set up where redistricting committees, and we call them redistricting committees, but really they are studying committees that are made up of parents, community members that are within the feeder patterns of those particular schools, so we involve the community. They sit down at the table and they begin to look at all the data for those schools. As Dr. Hahn mentioned earlier, they look at learning data, they look at class sizes, they look at the outcomes for all that, and it's a several month process that takes place. It's open to the public so people can listen. And as we make our way through, we make all the information available on the webpage. So as you do that, as Steve mentioned, you are going to run into things maybe that weren't thought about in the early stages of the process. But the beauty of it is you can always step back, you can expand the picture, and as you come through it for the next round, it will impact your decisions. I actually sat on, I was the chair of the Western Feeder Pattern Redistricting Committee, where we did look at Meriwether Lewis. We also did look, however, at the overall Western feeder pattern. And so it really was a discussion about how are we going to handle growth, which in my mind is really a problem you want. You know, around the state, there are school divisions that wrestle with consolidation because their school systems aren't growing. And usually that's a result of the overall economy in the area. And I feel that our school system is a key player in our economy. So while we are contributing to that, we're also contributing to a need for, you know, to a need for more space, more facilities, better facilities. And that's just an ongoing discussion we have.
And I just want to reemphasize the real critical importance of process. If you have a good, thoughtful, well-thought-out process, where you have the opportunity to listen to all opinions, usually whatever final decision the board makes is going to have a broad consensus of support, and even people who disagree with it, the result, appreciate that their voice was heard and the process took place. The real problem emotionally with redistricting is everybody loves the school that their kids go to. Nobody wants to move because they love the school their kids go to. But the reality is, after you redistrict, they're going to love their new school just as much or maybe even more. So as a school board member, the first redistricting, I had a tremendous amount of angst because people were so upset that I was moving them. But the following fall, when I talked to them and they said, oh, my new school, that's great. I really love it. It's a wonderful school. And so that relieved my future angst over redistrictings.
Well, let me ask quick about the methods used, because I don't want to focus too much on just on Albemarle. That's a great example with these specific schools mentioned, and it's important to our area. Again, it's what prompted my original efforts to getting the show together. But when the members of the school, the main office, put the work together to come up with the numbers and the decisions on this is how we should move forward, and then that information is put forth to the school board, and changes can, whether or not they, you know, will be made, but changes can be made. What is the effect there between putting forth your work to be done only to then be told no? Or let's do it a different way. Because you mentioned earlier about possibly having to step back because there were end results that you didn't affect. And I got this quote from somewhere. but one of the Albemarle County School Board members, when the topic discussion came up about elementary school and then therefore that required middle school, said, I'm not saying this isn't well thought, not saying it's not necessarily good ideas, but it's gotten me a bit uncomfortable that we went outside of the scope of the original charge.
Well, see, that shows a school board member being very concerned that we have good process. Mm-hmm. And that keeps going back to any advice I have to any other school district across the country, the state of Virginia or across the country. When you set up a redistricting committee or when you're dealing with these kind of difficult decisions, it's very important to have a good process where people's input is taken before the decision is made and where everyone is heard. And then people, I think, generally will accept the decision because they know it was made through a good process.
And the process in Albemarle County is very strong. Exactly what Dr. Haas and Mr. Colazar said. You know, you got the long-range planning who studies it first. And then they make a recommendation, should we look at redistricting? And then the superintendent makes a recommendation to the board about whether or not we should
consider
redistricting. Then the board has to vote to create a redistricting committee. And then we go out and do all the work that Dr. Haas and those folks did this year. And it was a month, 6 week process where there were just nightly meetings and input from community. Then they come back and make a recommendation to the superintendent who studies that with staff. And then that recommendation from the superintendent goes back to the board again. And then the board listens to it and takes public opinion and public hearing. And that meeting's coming up here soon where we can.
And that's a lot of process, only to then be told, wait a minute, you did a little more work than I wanted you to do. Am I incorrect on that? When a school board member says, wait a minute, I didn't want to know about middle schools yet. I think maybe you went a little too far. I just want to know about elementary school.
I think it's one of the checks and balances in the system. Right. I think it's absolutely wonderful. I think it's a check and balance piece that keeps us within the process to adhere to what the school board wants us to do, what they expect us to do, what the superintendent is, and most of all, what the community expects us to do. They expect that process to be in place for those checks and balances.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell you from experience, you know, this process sounds like it's long, hard work, tedious. It is long and hard work and tedious. But I can tell you, you don't go through that process and the board or a superintendent together make an arbitrary decision without the process. It's going to be much more kind of contentious and hard work to mend the fences that you've damaged because you did violate process.
Are you aware of any other, to take this a step out of Albemarle County, is this the same process that the majority of school systems, are you aware of any school systems that may not have this process and you've found that their steps work well because they've trimmed a little bit or found that they led to an error and that's why you keep the systems that you have?
Well, I think each division has to look at its own situation. For instance, in Loudoun County, they have so much rapid growth. They have to redistrict every year. They don't have the time to go through that process. We have the advantage in Albemarle County that our enrollment and things aren't changing that rapidly so that we can go through this process maybe every 2, 3, 4 years. And so therefore we have the time, the luxury of having the time to do a good process.
And Rick, I can give you examples just in the last 2 or 3 years of how this process has turned out differently for different situations. For example, a couple of years ago when Greer was overcrowded, they went through the process and looked, and what we realized there was that maybe some of the classrooms, some of the school just needed some refurbishing and some additions done. So in that case, we took care of that school being large by adding on an addition, updating classrooms, and updating the school. At Agner Hurt, we found out that, or Hollymead, we found out they were overcrowded, but there were seats available at Baker Butler, which wasn't going to put a lot of imposition on folks as far as travel or changing. So we did some redistricting, and that was just moving some students from one school to another. This year, we looked at Agner Hurt, and we're moving students to several schools that have available seats, and we're probably going to still come back and look at an addition because growth projections predict that Agner Hurt might still grow in the future. And then we looked at Meriwether Lewis, and that committee, I believe Dr. Haas came back with a recommendation. At this time, they recommended no movement at all. So, I mean, you get four different results out of four different schools in the same process, but you came up with four different results.
And I think that what that does demonstrate is we do listen. You know, we listen to the community. We take our time to study the data. We give lots of opportunities, whether it's an electronic survey or a public hearing, for people to give us more insights into the situation. And if it were a process with a pre-foretold outcome, we wouldn't come up with different results. And just to come back to what Steve was saying earlier, I really do think it depends on the local community, the kind of growth you're experiencing, the nature of the growth, where it's going on. And just want to come back to that statistic that I pitched out earlier, that this is a very large county with a lot of rural space in it. And so the decisions that have to be made about attendance zones for schools are critical in terms of transportation time for students, which impacts their instructional day. There are many things that revolve around our decisions. So whether or not we as staff or school board members always appreciate or see exactly what we may want to see in an outcome for a redistricting decision or any other decision that we have, it really comes down to, did we follow the process that we said we were going to follow?
Right. And for instance, going back to important or unimportant difficult decisions, we're going to have a work session this coming Thursday working with our long-range planning committee, determining what are the criterias, what are the policies, what are the procedures, what issues are important. And that creates the framework, which then the actual redistricting decision is made in. And if you have a framework, then again, that makes the process work.
One of our strategic goals is to be a world-class educational system. And what that amounts to for us is using a process we call continuous improvement. We think we're a great school system, but we believe in better. We always think we can get better. And it's a four-stage process. We plan, we do, we study what happens, and then we take new actions for more improvement. And that's a perfect example of this sort of process for us.
All right, 11:31 here on the Wake Up Call. Let's give out the number if you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment. 979-0919 877 WNRN Rocks. Again, our guest today, Steve Kolazar. He's the chairman of Albemarle County School Board. We have Assistant Superintendent Dr. Matthew Haas, as well as Dr. Billy Hahn. Gentlemen, you talked several times about the community. So when you have, how many schools are there? How many elementary schools are there?
16.
So it doesn't matter how many you have, if you rank 1 through 16, no matter how good 16 is, something will be ranked last. So the goal is always to make 16 as great as it can be, but you're still going to have somebody who ranks 1 and somebody who ranks 16. So when people move here to purchase their homes, they are rooting for, many times, where they purchase their home and which school feeder system they want to be in affects their purchase. So once they've purchased the home in the new community that they'd like, and then redistricting says, sorry, we're not going to put you in that track anymore. We're going to put your child in this track now. Do you get feedback about from parents like that? They may love the school that they're in next year, but it may not have been the track in which they purchased their home.
Well, I had somebody call me one time and ask me, moving to Albemarle County, what's the best elementary school in Albemarle County? And my answer to that is, what flavor do you like? I mean, because all our schools are excellent, but we have a wide diversity of schools in terms of student body, and it provides real opportunities for different kinds of educational experiences. We have rural, small elementary schools. We have suburban, affluent community schools. We have poverty schools. And they're all great schools, and they give a different experience because of the different natures of their population. But you can't really say that one is better than another. You know, it's when I first moved to Albemarle County, people said, oh, you shouldn't shouldn't move in the Walton district because that middle school is not as good. Well, I couldn't afford to live in a different district, so I moved into the Walton district, and it was the best educational experience my older son had between K-1 and graduating from Virginia Tech. Was the best educational experience, was this quote-unquote bad school that you didn't want your kids to go to.
But Dr. Hahn, don't you have, one of your duties as assistant superintendent for student learning, so that has a lot to do with which courses are taught at different schools. Mm-hmm. So do you have courses at some of the middle schools that are not available at others? And by that I mean, do you teach Italian at one of the middle schools that you might not teach at another?
At the middle schools, the major differences in courses would be in the electives. But as far as for the core subjects of math, science, social studies, and English, we offer the same things.
Understood. But the electives, that may be important to, and I see the phone ringing now that we got onto this. Are there electives that are available that a family may move to this feeder district because of those electives, and now they're told that they're not? How do you solve that problem?
That can be an issue, but mostly in our middle schools right now, we do offer a world language experience that includes Spanish or French. That would be the two subjects that are most popular. But at Sutherland, we do offer German. We do offer at Walton. We're offering some Chinese. Through some online virtual courses, but hopefully with the technology as it progresses, that we're going to be able to make sure that every child at every school gets the offers the same pieces.
And also, we do have a policy that it's okay for parents to request a change in district for educational reasons. So therefore, like for instance, we have a ROTC program at Monticello, we have a Health and Medical Sciences Academy at Monticello, we have
Math Engineering Science Academy
at Albemarle. And if parents want their children to be in that program, they can go there if they get accepted, even if they're out of district.
There you go. That's the kind of information I'm unaware of, and want to share with other folks. Because to me, and again, we're talking about a small number, right? Are we talking about 80 kids or so? Who may be affected by redistricting this time around?
But sometimes redistricting, like when we opened Monticello, we affected thousands of kids.
All right, we got a caller coming in. Guys, get your headphones on. And Kirk, hi, Kirk.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for the guests?
The proposed Western bypass goes by six schools, and two of them right in their backyards. And there are studies out that indicate that within 1,500 feet of a highway, there is decreased lung capacity in students that are exposed to air pollution and emissions. The World Health Organization declared diesel particulates to be carcinogenic. And we know that there will be increased asthma attacks.
All right, Kirk, I know where you're going, so let's let the guest get on with it. Gentlemen?
Well, our school board has had a longstanding policy that our mission is education and doing the best possible job educating the children of Albemarle County. We don't like to have the schools used as a political football in zoning and redistricting decisions that are being made, transportation decisions that are being made by the Board of Supervisors. That's their area of responsibility. That's their area of expertise. We're not going to get involved. That's their decision. Those facts should be presented to the Board of Supervisors, to the Transportation Department of Transportation. As a school system, we're not going to get involved.
All right. Let's take a quick break. I want to come back because that's going to lead us into a part of the process and decision-making that is political as we talk about budgeting next with our guest, Assistant Superintendent Dr. Matthew Haas, as well as Assistant Superintendent Dr. Billy Hahn, and Steve Colazar, who's the chairman of Albemarle County School Board.
Michelle Knuckles, mortgage banker with Westar Mortgage, joins our members in support of independent music radio WNRN. Westar can help with a purchase or refinance from first-time buyers to jumbo loans. You can reach Michelle at michelleknuckles.com. Two L's in Michelle, N-U-C-K-O-L-S.com. Westar Mortgage is an equal opportunity housing company. NMLS number 198053.
Hi, I'm Meg Hubeck, and I am the director of the Youth Leadership Initiative, YLI, at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. We are looking for your support in promoting quality civic education in our community. YLI is a nonpartisan effort dedicated to providing educators with engaging, rigorous, and thought-provoking simulations, lesson plans, and projects, all designed to create lifelong civic engagement. From our location in Charlottesville, we serve over 50,000 educators from across the nation. To learn more about YLI's free programs and resources, youthleadership.net. I'm Meg Hubeck, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
All right, back with our guests today, Steve Colazar, Dr. Billy Hahn, and Dr. Matthew Haas, talking about difficult decisions in the public school system. Redistricting, wherever you do it, doesn't seem to matter. There's always going to be questions and both positive and negative feedback from the parents and others in the county or the city. So let's talk about budgeting for a moment. Again, 979-0919. 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Steve Colazar, you mentioned how the goal was not to bring politics into the school system. But when you start talking about budgeting, certainly there are different sides of the political aisle that have viewpoints on what is important to do with the dollars spent and how much money should be given to the school system.
Okay, well, I'd like to clarify my earlier comment was about whose decision it was to make, whose role it was. It's the Board of Supervisors who are responsible for transportation planning, zoning, etc. It's not the school boards. So we don't want to get involved in their decisions. It's our decisions about what needs to be done for the expertise or for the excellence of our schools and the excellence of our students. Okay, the state constitution says that we need to provide to the Board of Supervisors a funding request that lays out what needs are to be spent for the schools. It's the Board of Supervisors' decision with their budget how much resources they're going to allocate to us. It's a political, there are differences of opinion within our own board and within the Board of Supervisors about where that line of how much money to give to the schools is. But you try to distinguish what your roles are. And we used to be more confrontational with our Board of Supervisors, saying, we need this, we need this. We'll get a lot of people out to the public hearing. And it wasn't a very effective strategy. And so what we've been doing much more now is working with our Board of Supervisors, explaining what we're doing with the money, explaining why we need the money, explaining why educational excellence is important to the county. And we've gotten much better support from the Board of Supervisors, including a tax rate increase last year.
Dr. Haas, when we talk about budgeting, what percentage of the budget goes towards the large projects? And that's not a fair way to put it. But when you think about students and teachers, mm-hmm. I want to know what percentage goes towards buildings and buses and other sort of large one-item purchases.
So, just to back up a little bit, just the overarching premise of public education. We live right here in the seat of Thomas Jefferson country, and Thomas Jefferson was famous for saying that one of the greatest inventions of mankind is public school. And so in many ways, Thomas Jefferson was a visionary without practical thinking. And I think the other part of that is where we try to figure out how to fund adequately and more than adequately our public school systems. Every child has potential, and our goal as a school system should be to help every child reach that potential. So just sort of get back to your question. When you talk about the bigger projects like funding school buses or adding on to buildings or building new school buildings, that is actually handled through a different process outside our operational budget process. That's through the Capital Improvement Program. And the Capital Improvement Program is a large fund. Well, it's not so large anymore as it was before before recent times, but it is a fund that where revenue is placed from the local government side where it accrues, and from that fund there is a set of projects that are laid out across the county, ranging from buying fire trucks. Looking at firehouses, looking at other sorts of public uses such as stormwater, drainage, libraries, those kinds of things. And schools rank within that list of projects. So that sort of sits outside the annual budget process that takes place. One of the recent changes we've experienced, though, is the placement of our school bus purchases within the capital improvement program. So that's handled by a different group. It's called the technical review team that annually looks at all the potential projects that can be funded out of the CIP or the capital improvements program, and they rank those based on importance to the county.
So buying new school buses, if that's the need that comes up, that doesn't you don't have to balance that against whether or not teachers are going to get a raise.
Not now, and perhaps in the past.
Prior years, yes. It might have. And of course, that's why we moved it to the capital improvement program, because if it comes up to what's going on in the classroom versus school buses are always going to have the lowest priority.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in the classroom. For many people, and I don't know the answer to this, has Albemarle been forced to increase classroom size? Because my homework shows that on a national basis, 52% of districts nationally have cut extracurricular activities. 62% have had to increase classroom size in the last 3 years, and then there's another number, 30-some percent, mm-hmm. who have considered it.
Okay.
Well, did you want me to?
Well, I guess I'd like to go on with that. Okay. Is, you know, we're very fortunate as we saw these hard times coming, mm-hmm. and we've planned for it, I think, very effectively. Even before the worst of the hard times hit, we restructured central office. Mm-hmm. We eliminated 17 positions out of our central office. And that started us in the right direction. We always try to, when we have to cut, we make these cuts as far from the classroom as possible. One year we did cut some positions and increased class size one student from grades 4 through 12. Fortunately, we've in the past had a fairly good class ratio, so it wasn't that big an impact. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, underpinning for these whole decisions, that the most important thing in education is the quality of the instruction and the quality of the learning in the classroom. And class size has a relatively minor impact versus the quality of the teacher. So maintaining that highest quality of teacher in terms of competitive compensation, but also in terms of investing a lot of money in quality staff development and other things that improves teaching in the classroom. That's, you know, when I talked about difficult decisions that are important, that's one of the most difficult but most important decisions we have to make.
And well, Dr. Hunt?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Sure. I would go back and also add to what Mr. Colazar said is, we are lucky. We have a community. We have a staff that works for the school division. And we have a school board who values what happens in our classrooms. They value class size. They also value programs. And I think one of the stats that probably was probably in a different place from what you were looking, I would guess that in a lot of school systems across the state and across the country, another thing that they have done in tight budget times is they have cut their funding for the arts program. programs. Our school system values that very much. Our community values that. So along with maintaining class size, we have also been able to keep in our elementary schools, we have PE teachers, we have art teachers, and we have music
teachers.
So
where is the cutting coming from? Because if you're forced to make cuts, right? I mean, in the last several years, the budget that has been sent forth to the Board of Supervisors has been sent back saying cut more money from it, and 17 positions in the main office don't account for the millions of dollars. So, Dr. Haas?
Well, that's right. You're very astute in those observations.
I have my moments.
Exactly. So, this year's budget, we'll spend in excess of $11,000 per student. And that sounds like a lot, but it's actually $500 less per pupil than we were spending 4 years ago. And the question is, where does that come from? And I want to come back to strategic planning, in particular because it just so happens right now we're going through our comprehensive strategic plan review. We've been hosting a series of community conversations. Our last town hall meeting will be on the 26th from 6 to 8 o'clock at Sutherland Middle School. So thanks for the short commercial. But it all comes back to our strategic plan. In 2005, our board adopted a strategic plan that had five overarching goals. One of those goals was to establish efficient systems for development, allocation, and alignment of resources to support the division's vision, mission, and goals. Now, that sounds like high talk, but and how does that actually turn into anything? Shortly thereafter, the school board enlisted the Virginia Policy Institute at Virginia Commonwealth University to study as an outside auditor our school system. And they developed what we now call the famous resource utilization study. And there was a slew of recommendations that came out of that resource utilization study that brought about significant changes in the way we operate the school system, including reducing bus routes, changing the way we use buses. When I started out teaching and as an assistant principal, when you went outside at the end of the day, you would hear all the buses humming away, running, and now they sit there quiet to reduce fuel consumption, and they have by over 20%, which you may say, well, how does that impact what happens in the classroom? Well, by controlling the thermostats, by zeroing in on our operational hours and bus routes and those features, we are able to, when we make cuts, as Steve mentioned earlier, we're able to keep those outside the classroom. By reducing those overall operational expenses, we've been able to maintain our class sizes. We've been able to maintain our programs that we sort of take for granted, our fine and performing arts program. And the other key thing is we've been able to be very competitive with our teacher salary.
But I just want to interrupt here for a second. We have had basically frozen salaries for 5 years.
Right.
And you think, well, that's just keeping things even. But actually, when you freeze your scale, you reduce your overall salaries because as your older senior teachers retire, who you pay more, and you're hiring first year and less experienced teachers, they get paid less. So even though everybody got paid the same who stayed in the school system, our overall teacher salaries went down.
Our beginning teacher salary has dropped in the last 4 years. I mean, because every time we freeze a salary, then the beginning salary drops another step along the way. So teacher salaries has been a big piece that we have done.
I think you're trying to signal us.
11:52 here on the wake-up call. Our guest today, Assistant Superintendents Dr. Matthew Haas and Dr. Billy Hahn, as well as the chairman of Albemarle County School Board, Steve Colazar.
WNRN and Blue Mountain Brewery present the Red Wing Roots Music Festival, July 12th through 14th, at Natural Chimneys Park in Mount Solon, Virginia. Hosted by the Steel Wheels and featuring Del McCurry Band, Sam Bush Band, Tim O'Brien, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, and J.D. McPherson. The full lineup and tickets can be found at redwingroots.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And WNRN says thanks to our sustaining member, Christina from Richmond, who just added to her generous membership contribution. So thanks, Christina. It's easy to become a member. Just go to WNRN.org and click on Donate. Start saving your funds, because in just about a month, WNRN will be doing our spring fund drive. So plan ahead. That's what we've been talking about during the hour here is planning ahead, and we'd like you to do that as well. All right, so let's talk about, as again, we talk about difficult decisions in the school systems. We're talking about budgeting. There are different thoughts on what the money should be spent on, and are you spending too much money? You can say that you're not going to give the teachers a raise this year. A freeze, I believe, was the term that was used. And you're going to get feedback from some that say that's what should be done. Teachers, you know, whatever. That's the pay. That's a fair pay. And others who say you can't get the best teachers if you don't pay better. And then there are others who have different points of view. You need more money spent on the art system. You need less money spent on athletics, et cetera. When you go through this difficult process, how do you weigh the balances?
The number one thing that we always want to look at is the whole school systems are about teaching and learning. It's about educating students. So that's always our number one goal. But there's a lot, like you referenced, Rick, there's a lot that goes into that, because you have to look at what's a well-balanced system. You know, we want to have students who leave our system, who walk across our stage every year at graduation, who are prepared to go out into the world. And that includes, being physically fit, understanding that. That understands being able to think, being able to reason. But it also understands it's still back to the three R's. You know, you still have to do the writing, reading, and the arithmetic. So you have to balance out that whole system. And fine arts programs, career and technical education programs, you have to balance all those pieces along the way. One of the things that we haven't talked about at all that we continually get from the state are unfunded mandates. You know, they keep adding in additional graduation requirements. For example, one of the things that's in our budget this year is actually the only new growth initiative that we have in this year's budget, Rick, is the fact that beginning with next year's freshman class, everyone's going to be required to take at least one virtual course as a graduation requirement. So we're going to have to go out and start creating more virtual opportunities for our students to be able to have courses to take virtually because we don't have a lot of those opportunities.
What do you do in a rural county that may have a significant number of families who don't have computer systems to participate virtually? Are you required to provide that?
I think, going back to that, one of our most interesting and best budget discussions in this process is there's two real initiatives that the board would like to be able to fund that we haven't been able to fund so far. And one of those is one-to-one computing, where all our students would have be provided with their own device, whether it be a pad or a computer. We're not quite sure which device. But before we can do that, one, we need the funds to do it, but also we need to make sure our staff is fully trained on how to teach intelligently and effectively in that new environment. And so we're probably, and the board hasn't made the final decision on this, but we're probably going to aim for that implementation in September of 2014, which gives us a year to work with our staff to prepare them for that environment.
All right, we got a call here that I want to take.
Okay.
11:57 on the wake-up call, just a few minutes left. But one of our, we got a call from Will. He's a student at Western Albemarle. Hey, Will.
Hi. I have been in the Albemarle County education system for the last 12 years. And one thing that you said that I completely agree with is the fact that the quality of the educator is the most important factor that determines the quality of the education. And one thing that I think that is completely underutilized is the voice of the students. Overall, since I've been in the system, the only time that I have been asked about the quality of my education is when the student was when the teacher was a graduate student. Mm-hmm. And I think that this should be something, just take 5 minutes, hand out a piece of paper, and rate your teacher. Maybe something that should be done every year, because I can't tell you how many teachers that I have struggled with simply because I don't think that they are fit to be teaching the level of course that they are. So I think that should be something that you could implement and would be cheap and effective to help, make the quality of education much greater.
All right, Will, just a couple minutes left on the program. Thanks. Great point. And I'm going to let our guest finish up our hour with that.
I would just like to say that's the great kind of thinking that we want and expect from all our students.
That's Will, you couldn't advertise our work better, and you've been well prepared.
Great call and comment, yeah. But what about the follow-up on whether how it should be used or can't be used?
So just in terms of teacher student feedback on teachers, one of the changes we made this year to our teacher performance appraisal is that every teacher on their recertification year and teachers that are non-tenured, the students have an opportunity to provide feedback through an anonymous survey with those teachers. So it's going to take a while for that really to become embedded in the culture of what we do, but I do see it as a significant change, and hats off to Will for pointing that out.
And I would add also that Will's exactly right. With this new virtual piece, Jen Sublett, one of our lead coaches, and I have actually gone and visited the student council at each school and a group of students to get their input on virtual courses and what that would look like, what courses they're interested in, what they would be interested in taking, how we should implement that process. So, Will, you're exactly right. Student input is extremely important into making great decisions.
And student, we've underutilized students as a resource for improving our schools. No doubt about that.
All right, that finishes us up. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. We could continue to talk about difficult decisions, but I see you're all sweating from having to go through the hour with that.
Because it's hot in here.
Our guest, thank you. That's our guest, Steve Colazar. He's the chairman of Marl County School Board, our assistant superintendent for student learning, Dr. Billy Hahn, as well as our assistant superintendent for organizational and human resource leadership, Dr. Matthew Haas. Thank you. Next week, I'll be out of town. My mother has one of those birthdays with a zero at the end of it. So we'll be doing one of my favorite shows, Privacy in the Modern World, UVA professor Siva Vaidyanathan, author of The Googleization of Everything, that show always modern and current. Thanks, everybody.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Angie Cruz. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.